How Trump's tariffs go after the little guy, like Guyana. How elderly residents are getting evicted in Fort Lauderdale. And how spring breakers behaved in Miami Beach. Welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at how the reciprocal tariffs President Trump slapped the whole world with stand to affect the world closest to us, Latin America, especially small countries like Guyana. We'll also examine the controversial ouster of the elderly from their residences at the Oasis Living Quarters in Fort Lauderdale, and why this sort of thing has become a trend in South Florida. And we'll review how Miami Beach's new, stricter approach to spring break played out. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvingo. Just a reminder that you can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. Well, a couple of weeks ago, the alliance between the U.S. and the small South American nation of Guyana looked strong. During a visit from Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Guyana promised the U.S. preferential participation in Guyana's oil boom, while Rubio promised Guyana U.S. protection from any invasion by Venezuela, which claims most of Guyana's territory and its oil. This is how geopolitical partnership should look. And then, just days later, President Trump inexplicably ambushed Guyana with a severe 38% tariff on the goods it exports to the U.S. It was the highest duty any country in the Americas received amid Trump's worldwide tariff frenzy. As we know, Trump backed off this week and is now only slapping 10% tariffs on everybody except China. But even 10% can be onerous for small developing economies like Guyana, which need trade with the U.S. to become bigger, more developed economies. Wesley Curtin is a former Guyanese diplomat who is today president of the Guyanese American Chamber of Commerce here in Miami. Mr. Curtin is also executive director of the World Trade Center Georgetown. Georgetown is Guyana's capital. And in that role, he joins me now from Nice, France. He's attending the World Trade Center's Association Forum in Marseille, where I assume they're discussing the Trump tariff crisis. Mr. Curtin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Patrick.
As I mentioned, like all countries now except China, Guyana is looking at a 10% tariff instead of the 38% duty President Trump originally wanted to hit your native country with. Still, how big a shock was it when you and every other Guyanian saw how harshly Trump originally wanted to punish Guyana, especially just days after President Irfan Ali and Secretary of State Rubio shook hands on a U.S.-Guyana alliance?
Well, indeed, we were shocked. And initially, we were unsure how they arrived at the 38%. And then I think we came around to understanding the formula they used, which was to take our exports to the U.S., the value of our exports, as against the value of our imports from the U.S., and take that percentage difference and divide it by two. And so you have 50%. But that was a very unfair formula because, one, for years, the U.S. has been enjoying a trade surplus, a huge trade surplus, with Guyana until Guyana started to export oil
right
to the United States. Energy products, including oil, do not attract any tariffs into the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't understand why they would take the value of that oil.
Right. Yeah, and there are a lot of other small countries around the world like Lesotho in Africa, for example, that got hit with high tariffs, and they couldn't understand the formula that was being used to hit them with those high tariffs either. Mr. Curtin, how badly would that 38% tariffs have hurt Guyana and its economic development efforts if it had stuck?
Oh, it would have hurt us tremendously. I think it would have thrown a lot of small and medium-sized enterprises that depend on the U.S. market, would have turn around a business, it would have put hundreds, if not thousands, of people out of work, and really it was going to be a significant negative impact on the economy.
Right.
Remember, Guyana, as the rest of CARICOM, enjoys one-way duty-free entry of products, a range of products, into the United States right. under what used to be the CBI and is now called the Caribbean Basin Economic Recovery Act.
Right.
And we are really hoping not only in Guyana, but in the entire CARICOM.
Right. Now, as I mentioned before, Guyana's big export now is oil, potentially billions of barrels that were discovered off the country's shores a decade ago. But what else does Guyana export to the U.S., and how will a 10% tariff affect the economic development of a small and relatively poor country like Guyana, especially since history shows you don't want to rely on just oil to drive that development, right?
Exactly. So, you know, we export agricultural produce. We export rum. We export some seafood. We export timber. Gold. So, you know, this would be really, really unfortunate
right.
for our economy because, again, we used to enjoy a zero
right.
Tariff, and so now we've got to adjust to 10%.
And really, what do you want people to know, Mr. Curtin, about how much these minimum baseline tariffs of 10% will affect, if not hurt, small and developing countries in Latin America and especially the Caribbean? In fact, I know you pointed out just now how, you know, this is a big issue now for the Caribbean community or CARICOM. How is CARICOM going to respond to this?
Well, you know, I was just at the World Trade Center's General Assembly and Business Forum in Marseille, where we heard from the Deputy Director General of the WTO. And
WTO being the World Trade Organization. Yeah.
World Trade Organization.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she has asked the private sector globally to work with governments to ensure the maintenance of a rules-based global trading system. And in that context, I think we in CARICOM would hope that the United States would respect and honor agreements that they have entered into with countries in the CARICOM region in particular, such as Caribbean Basin
right.
Economic Recovery Act.
Do you think the Caribbean economies, whose performances have a big effect on our communities here, do you think the Caribbean economies can maybe negotiate with President Trump to even get less than 10% tariffs at this point?
Well, I'm hoping that, you know, there are avenues that are going to be open. I think we in the diaspora have to lobby our elected officials to help us here
mm-hmm.
And to, you know, get the message across to yeah. the Trump administration that, look, CARICOM countries are, for the most part, very vulnerable. They are island nations that are subject to the worst effects of climate change. We are small economies that are still struggling with a number of negative impacts of the global economic landscape. So
right.
really think that we in the diaspora, we in Florida, have a role, a significant role to play
right.
in working with governments, working with private sectors from other countries countries in Latin America and around the world to get the message across
right.
that, look, some of us deserve some special treatment.
I want to step back here, Mr. Curtin, and look at the larger diplomatic or geopolitical picture, especially as it involves the threat Guyana feels from Venezuela's dictatorship right next door. As I mentioned, Venezuela says it has a historic claim on more than two-thirds of Guyana's territory and therefore a claim on all that new oil. The issue is being heard in the world court right now, but in the meantime, Venezuela is rattling sabers at Guyana and the U.S. has pledged to protect Guyana. Does this tariff situation, or betrayal, if you want to call it that, affect that U.S.-Guyana alliance at all, to your mind?
Well, one, I think all Guyanese would hope is that America, would stick to its pledge should the need arise for America to come to Guyana's assistance to take on the Venezuelans should they exercise a military option. We hope it never comes to that. But I think we believe that, and we trust America to be, to live up to their commitments, both in terms of trade and in terms of our defense, should our sovereignty and territorial integrity be threatened or militarily threatened by Venezuela.
Now, along those lines, tell us, Mr. Curtin, how Guyana's oil boom is coming. Analysts, for example, suggest the country could become one of the world's top three oil producers in not too long a time. What are the pros and cons of that for a country like yours, especially in an age when the world is supposedly moving away from fossil fuels?
Well, I think, first of all, we have got to, it's a resource that we have, and we have to exploit it and earn from it. There's no question about that. But at the same time, I think we are, as a country, continuing to, look at renewables. So there's no question about, we haven't abandoned renewables on our quest to develop our renewables. However, I think we must. It is imperative that the government of Guyana manages the resources of the oil industry very, very effectively. I think we've got to ensure that we don't become a victim of the Dutch disease.
Right, where oil can become a curse instead of a blessing,
exactly.
As we've seen right next door in Venezuela.
Finally,
Mr. Curtin, what would you say is the developing world's message to President Trump and the U.S. when it comes to free trade and especially fair trade in situations like Guyana's in the 30 seconds we have left here?
Well, that is exactly why there was a WTO. Before WTO, there was that, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, so as to ensure that smaller countries, developing countries, could trade on a fair basis.
Right.
That they can get most favored preferential treatment.
Mr. Curtin, I'm sorry, we'll have to leave it there. Wesley Curtin is president of the Guyanese American Chamber of Commerce in Miami. He spoke with me from the World Trade Center's Association Forum in Marseille, France. Mr. Curtin, many thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Still to come, are the elderly being unfairly evicted in Fort Lauderdale? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Just a reminder, you can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. We seem to learn each week just how precarious housing can be in South Florida. In Miami-Dade County, the median cost of a single-family home is 10 times more than the median single-family income. It's even worse for renters. And when you do think you found a secure place to live, eviction can come at you faster than a Trump tariff, as the residents of the Lil Abner Mobile Home Park in Sweetwater have found out in recent months, for example. Now, in Broward County, we're hearing of another controversial eviction drama, this time involving the elderly residents of a Fort Lauderdale senior facility called Oasis Living Quarters. Last month, with apparently little or no notice, they were told they'd have to move out of Oasis because its owner wants to turn it into luxury rental apartments. But a judge has now blocked that. Either way, housing advocates are calling this a growing trend here, on top of all the other housing crises we face. WPLG Local 10 News broke the Oasis Living Quarters story, and joining me is the reporter who broke it, Andrew Perez. Andrew, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Big fan of the show.
Well, thanks. And congrats on the great reporting. How, in fact, did you hear about what was happening at the Oasis living quarters up there?
So this all started with, of all places, messages on Instagram that somebody told me about what was going on. I told my bosses, and they said, okay, go check it out. Got in touch with some of the families of residents at this facility, and you need to keep in mind here, you know, we're talking about residents, some who are bedbound, who suffer dementia, there's a memory care unit, an ALF, and there's an independent living part of this facility. It's a very big complex.
Right, and how many elderly residents are we talking about in that facility, Andrew?
So by the time I got there were only about 100 left, because right. They've been phasing people out. It's a very complicated, long story, but half of the facility has already been converted into luxury apartments. You know, they moved residents out of the independent living side and then moved them to the other side of the complex and kind of put everybody together, you know, between two different buildings.
Right.
But right now what happened was, with the remaining residents that were there, they get these very vague notices that we had photos of on their doors that said, hey, there's an emergency meeting, mandatory, you have to be there or you have to have a representative there on your behalf on March 5th. These residents go there, the ones who can, representatives show up there, nursing aides go to this meeting, and across the board, they're all telling us, they are told that they have 30 days to get out.
Right, and 30 days to get out, because what is it exactly that the Oasis owners want to turn this senior living facility into?
So these residents say that they are told that they want to convert the rest of this complex into luxury apartments. Again, half of the complex has already been converted.
Yeah.
And everybody was moved over. So now they want to turn the rest of it into luxury apartments and completely renovate it. The way these residents are told is, hey, we're doing renovations. You have to leave within 30 days. And then when you come back, you know, you're more than welcome to come back, but there's not going to be
ALF. If you want to come back, you have to come back in the capacity of a luxury apartment renter.
Exactly. There's not going to be an ALF. There will not be memory care. You're not going to get buses, and you're not going to get, you know, your meal services, because they have, you know, a cafeteria
right.
that you would have at a senior center and other amenities like that. So obviously, this was very shocking to everybody
right.
across the board.
And I want to play a clip here from one of the family members of the elderly residents there whom you interviewed. His name is David Comras, and this is what he claims happened.
They were, in essence, evicting all of the tenants that are here that live in the assisted living facility. For them to do it in this capacity, in this manner, it's just disrespectful to the elderly.
So, Andrew, since you started reporting the story last month, has what the residents and the family members, like David Comras, have they been borne out? Did the owners of Oasis just drop this eviction news on these elderly residents with little or no notice, as he's claiming?
To this day, and this has even gone to court, because David Comras specifically, he got an injunction against Oasis. He took this to court just to get them to stop.
Yeah.
To this day, we have yet to find any documentation about a written notice saying you guys have to leave within this time frame. So obviously, you know, everybody's like, is it 30 days? Is it 45 days? Well, you know, everybody's just working off of word of mouth here.
Yeah.
Once we finally pushed, by the fourth time we followed up on this story, we finally pushed for documentation. We get documentation that was dated in February. I encourage you to go to our website as well and read it.
Mm-hmm.
It is a February letter that all of these residents got saying, we are renovating the dining room, pardon our dust, kind of thing. you might notice some interruptions to some service. And they submitted that to the state agency as proof that they gave notice.
Well, what is the response then of the Oasis owners to the accusations being made against them?
Mum's the word. No, you know, everybody's very tight-lipped, staying quiet, and I feel like based on the last story that I just did, I have a better idea why. Because, the state agency for healthcare went in there,
mm-hmm.
and they filed a very long, detailed 30-page report after our investigation. And then you also had building inspectors with the city of Fort Lauderdale.
Fort Lauderdale, right, yeah.
Yeah, and they realized, oh my gosh, they've already started renovating everything while people are still moving out with no permitting for anything. No permitting to convert the facility from an ALF to luxury apartments. No permitting for the work that was done. You know, they went in there and they saw, these are just a list, a short list of some of the things that they found. New AC units were already installed, kitchenettes were demolished, hallway corridor partitions were removed and demolished. And I noticed, I called the city about it because I noticed this feeling that all of these workers that I'm seeing on site during my fourth or fifth visit, that they were literally hiding. They would come out with, you know, torn-out drywall and then turn around and go right back inside.
So, Andrew, the state and Fort Lauderdale inspectors essentially were saying, hey, you can't, you know, move forward with this, you know, under the circumstances. And a judge apparently agreed with them, right?
Yeah, a judge said they need to give proper notice. You know, you're dealing with a very specific group of people. And, I mean, in general, everybody should be getting 30 days notice on paper, very specifically. So the point
and
that
remind us who this judge was.
I do not.
No, that's okay. But it was a Broward County judge, right?
Correct. Yeah, it was David Comrat that was in court. One of the residents also testified.
Right. And the judge essentially then blocked this from moving forward for the moment. Is that correct?
Correct. But here is the other thing. A lot of these residents have already left because services are being cut back. Dining services are being cut back. Everything else that they rely on is being cut back. So David Comrat specifically, he actually just told me the other day, he's like, the few remaining residents that are there, it's like they're choking them out.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're going to get out one way or another. And I also just want to be clear, you know, even in speaking with attorneys about this and some of the follow-ups we've done, they have every right to convert this ALS into luxury apartments if they so choose, the owners.
Uh-huh.
There's just a process to go about doing
that. Right, exactly. That's what's at issue here. But as I mentioned earlier, Andrew, housing advocates here warn that this sort of questionable eviction practice, which, as we said, is really the bottom line here, not whether or not they have the right to do it, but the way they're doing it, has become a trend in South Florida. I mentioned the Little Abner Mobile Home Park situation here in Miami-Dade County, and some suggest it's a trend that's been working its way down here from the Northeast. Tell us more about what these housing advocates are telling you about this wider issue.
Well, specifically, I know Michael Brezza, he's an attorney with the Senior Justice Law Firm in Boca. He's seen many cases like this, and he was one of the people telling me this is a trend coming from New York, New Jersey, these owners that snatch up ALS, essentially, and convert them into luxury property just when the real estate market in whatever given area is hot. And one of the questions that I asked him, and I'm not in this situation, I'm not speaking about Oasis specifically, because there's still a lot to unravel with exactly what went down. But in terms of just the bigger picture trend that a lot of these advocates have been seeing across the country, you know, I asked him, why? I guess what is the point? Why not? You know, they're still making money, and they said there's just more money to be made on the real estate side of things, and in terms of not giving notice and doing this so quickly, you're essentially keeping a head in every bed up until the point that you take the time to quickly convert the property and get families in there who pay rent.
Well, do advocates say that's particularly ethical?
No, of course not. You know, but the question is it legal or not? You know, how much of it is legal? And is it more that there are some deficiencies in law? You know, should there be more notice? Should there be something to protect renters and people who rely on these ALFs more?
Well, just real quickly then, Andrew, should we just assume then that this facility is eventually just going to be another luxury, unit of residents in South Florida?
Well, yeah. I mean, like I mentioned, the city had already noted that they've already started. You know, while I think there's a handful, maybe two or three residents left at last check, and they've already started converting all of these units. At least they have to stop until they meet the city now.
Yeah.
It's on its way.
Andrew, before we leave you, we know you've been covering a tragic small plane crash there in Boca Raton. Three people have apparently been confirmed killed in that accident. What else can you tell us? Where exactly did this occur?
Yeah, so right now we're right near North Military Trail and Glades Road. So we're very close to I-95. This is a very busy area. What we know is that a Cessna 310, it crashed at around 10:20, and it departed from Boca Raton Airport with three people on board, and it was headed to Tallahassee International Airport. Based on the flight aware data and based on a lot of the pilots who were listening to the scanner chatter, there was some sort of mechanical issue with the rudder, and it appears that the rudder was stuck to one side. You can see the plane through the flight data. It was basically going in circles, only going left, doing quite a few loops before it ultimately crashed. All three souls on board did pass away. That was confirmed a short time ago. And there was also a driver on North Military Trail. The plane, it crashed on the railroad tracks in the area,
yeah.
But it caused this huge fireball, and well, this driver drove yeah. right through that, but the driver is okay.
Well, thanks for that reporting, Andrew. We appreciate it. That's a sad, tragic story. Andrew Perez is a reporter for WPLG Local 10 News here in South Florida. Andrew, many thanks.
No, thank you.
Still to come, is Miami Beach finally catching a break with spring break? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Just a reminder, you can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. Well, we're all familiar with the so-called divorce Miami Beach had with spring break and spring breakers a couple years ago, when shooting deaths and riotous crowds gave the city the image of Mad Max with palm trees, fairly or not. Last year, Miami Beach cracked down, stricter curfews, for example, and significantly increased parking and towing fees. And it worked. The city saw no shootings or other violent episodes in March of 2024. The question was whether Miami Beach could repeat that spring break tranquility this year. The city doubled down with measures like license plate readers, DUI checkpoints, and significantly increased police presence. And again, it worked. But certain questions linger, like, has the crackdown meant too big a hit for Miami Beach businesses? Has it disproportionately targeted Black and other minority spring break visitors? And has it driven too many spring breakers to rival destinations like Fort Lauderdale? Joining me now in the studio here is Miami Beach Commissioner Alex Fernandez, who has led much of the city's spring break reform effort. Commissioner Fernandez, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
So as I said, the measures Miami Beach took last year worked. But even so, what more did the city feel still needed to be done this year? Walk us through the added steps you took for this spring break that just ended, like the license plate readers.
Right. Well, license plate readers, DUI checkpoints, making sure that individuals that had arrest warrants were intercepted by the police and were arrested before they could penetrate our city to create chaos, to create shootings, to create the loss of life that has affected our city in the past. And the difficult thing about that in past spring breaks is that not only was it affecting spring break, but when people would see the headlines of stampedes, of shootings, yeah. of loss of life in Miami Beach around the world, because those headlines would circulate the globe, then all of a sudden, the hotel owners would complain. They would see a sudden dip in reservations and cancellations,
right.
effective immediately, cancellations for later in the year. And that's the effect that we were trying to avoid.
Now, as you pointed out in an op-ed you wrote recently in Miami Herald, one of the big factors here was the increased police presence. And the Miami Beach Police Department created this what's called real-time intelligence center. The name almost sounds like a terrorist prevention program, but what sort of intelligence are we talking about here? I think you already started to mention that earlier.
Well, not only the license plate readers, but over 850 cameras with 1,600 live feeds coming into a centralized location, paired together with calls from our 911 dispatch, together with other technology, for example, drones. We're now deploying drones from the top of our police station to anywhere within our entertainment district. And in less than a minute, you have police resources that are available providing live feed to our intelligence center that's at the same time providing more information to officers before they even get to the scene of a situation.
And the Florida Highway Patrol helped out in this as well, right?
Tremendous support from the Florida Highway Patrol and Governor Ron DeSantis joined forces once again. And again, it's that force multiplier of not just the Miami Beach Police Department, even the school board police of Miami-Dade County, the state of Florida, have all been part of this effort.
Now, one of the things you also argue in your op-ed is that while these measures reduced spring break rowdiness, they did not reduce, for example, spring break hotel occupancy. You believe that this crackdown is compatible with Miami Beach business.
Well, the numbers speak for themselves. We are still the highest in the nation amongst major U.S. Destinations. Highest hotel occupancy in the nation. I mean, we got to realize 83% average hotel occupancy for the month of March, some as high as 85%. And that is significant. When you speak to the tourism professionals, they will tell you to have an 85% hotel occupancy is top of the nation.
Now, there are some Miami Beach business owners who aren't as sanguine about that, however. One local bar owner on Lincoln Road, Jason DeCastro, told Channel 7, for example, quote, "It really is a shame. The city breaking up with spring break has really crippled the food and beverage industry on South Beach." How do you respond to complaints like his?
It's true. I mean, we need to look at some of these measures, blocking of sidewalks, eliminating sidewalk cafes during spring break, some of our parking restrictions. We got to look at some of these measures and see how can we coexist, being a city of tourism while at the same time allowing our businesses to be successful. So I can't claim success until we find a way that we can sustain public safety while sustaining business activity, because our businesses are hurting. But what is not happening now, in past years, we had businesses voluntarily closing during spring break. Employees fearful to show up to work because they were scared that they would end up in the middle of a stampede. And that's what we've been able to eliminate.
So this is still a work in progress, finding the right mix of how to do this.
We cannot operate a city that closes streets, that closes sidewalk cafes, because this is what people want. And we cannot allow our businesses to suffer. We have to coexist.
There is also the concern that these measures tend to impact Black and other minority spring break visitors. You mentioned in your op-ed that this time the Miami Beach Commission, quote, engaged with the Black Affairs Advisory Committee and Goodwill Ambassadors to address that issue. What's being done differently now to be more sensitive to that issue?
Well, we enforce crimes. We don't enforce race. And I'll tell you, the amount of white males, for example, arrested this spring break went up by 36%. And so this is not an issue of race at all. This is an issue of criminal behavior. I'll tell you what we didn't have this year. We didn't have spring breakers shot and killed in our city. And whether someone is Black or white, I don't want any spring breaker to fall victims of crimes. And that's what was happening in the past. We had kids getting killed in our streets, including Black kids. And that's not right for anyone. And so I think the key thing here is this is not an issue of race at all. And when you look at the numbers with our measures, in fact, the amount of Black people being arrested reduced.
Finally, Commissioner, a Miami Herald editorial this morning made an interesting sort of two-pronged point that I want to engage with you. On the one hand, it noted that Miami Beach does have to be careful not to push too many of its spring break visitors to places like Fort Lauderdale, but at the same time, it also has to start becoming less economically dependent on spring breakers and tourism in general, the editorial said. When we talk about the future of Miami Beach, what are your thoughts on that double point the Herald made?
Sure. Listen, we need to start tapping into our cultural scene. We have some of the most distinguished cultural institutions in Miami Beach, and we have to be incentivizing more of that activity. We need to be incentivizing more live, work, play. We're looking at increasing the amount of housing availability, for example, on Washington Avenue and on Lincoln Road, so that the businesses there have full-time residents who can sustain the economy of those establishments and rely less on seasonal tourists that are not here year-round. And so as a commission, not only are we supporting arts and cultures and institutions like the Miami City Ballet and the Bass Museum and the Wilsonian and so many other wonderful cultural institutions so that they can succeed, but we're looking at increasing our housing inventory, looking at creating opportunities on Washington Avenue and on Lincoln Road so that the missing middle can live in our city, not luxury housing, but housing for the average workforce so that those individuals can live in our city and sustain the economy of the businesses that right now are suffering in our city.
In the 30 seconds we have left then, what is your advice to any other spring break destination in the country about how to start changing the culture of spring break?
Listen to their public safety officials. That's key. Listen to their public safety officials, and we have a good playbook here in Miami Beach that they can download at miamibeachfl.gov to follow along.
That's handy news. Thanks. Alex Fernandez is a Miami Beach City Commissioner. Many thanks to you, sir. We really appreciate it, and congratulations.
Thank you, and especially to our businesses and our residents for cooperating with us. I know it's not easy, but we'll keep on working.
Finally on the roundup, we want to pay tribute to a special public broadcasting pioneer, former WLRN General Manager Don McCullough, who died last weekend. Don was raised in Miami and started his career as a teacher. That education vocation led him to this station in the 1960s, and in the 1970s, he came up with the station's new name, WLRN, to reflect its learning and community-driven mission. Don McCullough was 97. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. We want to wish our Jewish friends a happy Passover. Chag Pesach Sameach. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Today's show was produced by Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our Director of Original Live Programming. Mateo Sanchez is Digital Director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's Vice President of News, the Vice President of Radio, and the show's Technical Supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.